Hey, true believers, it is once again time for another installment of the Fantastic Forecast. Four issues every 4 weeks for you. I am your co-host, Adam Vermillion.
Who's new to the Fantastic Four?
Newish. That voice that you hear is my comic guru on this journey from the Baxter Building to the Negative Zone and back. Who is it?
It's me, your charming and delightful old Uncle Rap Bastard, also known as Corey Strode. And I've been reading the Fantastic Four since 1975. I don't want to hear it.
Oh, that...
That I've been reading longer than you've been alive? Yes, I realize.
But only by 1 year. Only by 1 year.
Only by 1 year.
That's not too bad. I've known who the FFR, who they've been since, like the early 80s.
Well, that's good.
There we go. But reading these stories for the first time, if you missed episode one, and why would you have missed episode one?
You can still go back and listen.
You could go back and listen, but if you're new to the podcast, welcome. Episode two, where we're going to talk about the next four issues of the Fantastic Four.
And it'll be shorter.
It'll be a little shorter, because we're both getting older, and as you get older, you shrink. No, it's no history to go through this time. Maybe a little bit of history, but no setup.
Little history, but no setup.
We won't walk it through, and I don't know. Do we want to jump in, or before we start with the episodes, say something about Stan before we get going, since he did pass away?
I think
this week
there have been a lot of podcasts and remembrances and everything about Stan over the years. If you want my feelings on the passing of Stan Lee, Joe and I did a special episode on the show I call The Mothership for the Solitaire Rose Network, and that's Crazy Comics and Stories. We go into our personal reminiscences, the times we met him, the history of Stan in comics, clearing up some misconceptions, and for the Fantastic Four, I'm going to touch on things that made the Fantastic Four special that Stan brought that just didn't exist in other comics at the time. So there's really no way to speak about the Fantastic Four without remembering Stan Lee and Jack Kirby, because that first 102 issues built the foundation of the Marvel Universe. So much of what is still being used is in these books. So I think every episode is really a tribute to the both of them.
The best way to put it. To follow Corey, if you want to hear my thoughts on Stan Lee and his passing and his legacy, check out episode 6 of my new show, For the Love of Comics, where guest Magdalene Visaggio and I talk about Stan before we talk about her. So check that out. Over on Fancy Pants Gangsters.
So you're on two networks.
I'm on two networks, yeah. It's diversifying. Let's go for a third. Anybody out there want me? I don't know. I don't know if I could swing a third podcast. I'm not Corey. That's his superpower.
It seems to be. Matter of fact, we've got all kinds of podcasts. Why don't we just drop all the stuff about all the podcasts that we do here at Solitaire Rose right here. The Solitaire Rose Radio Network has all sorts of podcasts. We've got Scrabbling Across the West with Dave Cafell and his lovely bride, Stephanie. They travel across the country playing musical gigs, and at night they sit down to play Scrabble and talk about their day at scrabbling.solitairerose.com. There's Novelcast over at novels.solitairerose.com, where I take the novels that I've written and turn them into audio podcasts. Currently, we are doing a novel called Do the Job, which is a murder mystery set in the world of 1980s professional wrestling. Then, over at badadvice.solitairerose.com, me, Corey Strode, and Wolfie B. Bad, along with Dan Moore, give bad advice to people who send in questions. That's bad advice over at badadvice.solitairerose.com. The Solitaire Rose Radio Network is growing. Be there! You think NBC will get mad I used that?
get it out of the way.
They're mixing it up a bit. With the Fantastic Four, we did the first four issues. Our feeling on it is that the first one is a classic. The second one was fun. The third one was not very good.
Mm-mm.
And the fourth one was amazing because the fourth one introduced us to the Submariner. The fifth one introduces the Fantastic Four's other major villain. And I know that you're pretty excited about talking about it. And that is where we meet Dr. Doom.
Dr. Doom, Victor Von Doom, the, you know, best villain, if you could call him a villain. He's not a villain. He's
he
the hero of his own
issue.
Story. He's very much a villain in this issue. I love Dr. Doom, and I love how pompous he is and how much he hates Reed Richards. So I don't know why. I just dig it. So, but this first appearance of Dr. Doom, I don't know. I mean, we get a good background on him a little. You know, he mixes science and sorcery, as it says there on page one, with his books, and he likes to play games. And but I don't know. It's not the most exciting first appearance for who I think is the greatest villain of the Marvel Universe.
A couple of things about this issue. This is the last of the bi-monthly issues. With issue 6, they go monthly. So if you look on the cover, this one is July. And then the issue 6 is September. Issue 7 is October. So Fantastic Four moved pretty quickly into being a monthly series. And this was back when you started a book almost. Marvel didn't do it as much, but a lot of people would start a book as a quarterly. Then if it sold, they'd bring it up to a bi-monthly. And then if it sold really well, they'd bring it up to monthly. Very different from now. And it showed that the Fantastic Four was a success right off the bat. The other thing, you know, the credits are just where Stan and Jack signed it, but you will notice that the art on this issue looks very different in that this was the first issue inked by Jolton Joe Sinnott.
Oh.
And as you look through it, you'll actually see where a lot of the panels actually look like stuff that was done much later in the series. When Sinnott took over as a regular inker in the mid-40s till Kirby left. But there were a lot of panels where I looked at it, it's like, wow, that looks like Kirby stuff much later in the series.
Okay, yeah, there is a, now that you bring it up, a lot, there's a huge difference in the inking style between this and the last issue.
Yep, and our introduction to Dr. Doom is he's playing with figures of the Fantastic Four. Has a, is that a vulture?
Yeah, a vulture or a buzzard or
some sort of carrion bird. And he's got a book, one that says demons and one that says science and sorcery. The fact that he was a scientist who also played with the black arts right there in his first appearance. And I think that's one of the things that makes Dr. Doom special to me is that he's not just a super scientist, he's also a magician. And that plays a part in a number of stories going forward, but it also plays a part in this story.
Yes, it does. It does. I like it because right then and there, this panel, it shows, and as you get to know Doom, that the science just isn't enough.
Right.
You need to find a way to make the science even better. And why not use some magic to do that?
And he's also going to be a little different in that he says right there, the Fantastic Four, they're just pawns in the hands of Dr. Doom. He's not going to be somebody who punches them in the face. He's going to be very manipulative. I think also, I want to double check, but I think this is the first splash page that didn't have the Fantastic Four on it. Other than the figures. In 3, there they are at the bottom of the page, across the bottom. Number two is the thing swimming out to destroy a oil drilling rig. And then on number one, of course, we've got the Fantastic Four right across the top. So we start focusing on the villain.
Yeah, and that's a good indicator of how huge this villain's going to be. Even if his scheme is a little silly.
Well, it's a little silly, but another thing about it is that we don't get in this story, we don't hear anything about Latveria. Nowhere in this story does it say that he's not just outside Central City, which is where the Fantastic Four are currently. I don't think they name it as New York yet. They might name it as New York, but he's just in a castle outside of town.
Oh, he's just outside of town. Oh, my gosh. Okay.
Yeah, because he's just using a helicopter.
Okay. Okay. I like his helicopter. I don't know what the significance of it looking like a shark is, but... it just looks cool.
It's very streamlined. The next page, Johnny Storm is reading the Hulk.
I noticed that. There's more kind of like meta commercial for Marvel comics within the comic itself.
And remember when, because the Omnibus reprints the pages exactly as they were printed, in previous issues you had along the top and the bottom of the art, the Hulk is coming, who is the Hulk, what is the Hulk... the Hulk will be thrilling. Here we find out it's another comic, a great new comic mag.
Shameless.
And, of course, you know, we start off with the fight between the Human Torch and the Thing.
You need it. It wouldn't be right.
It shows this off their early powers. Anyway. Shows off their powers, yes. Within the first few pages. And Dr. Doom waits till everybody has left the Baxter Building except the Fantastic Four. In future issues... the Baxter Building's kind of where people live, but in this one, it's where people work. So they're still kind of figuring out what they want to do. The plot of the story starts with the Dr. Doom puts a special net over the Baxter Building so that the Fantastic Four can't get out. And we also get a very quick origin of Dr. Doom, where he was Reed Richards's roommate. But we also see that he was, I, Von Doom, have mastered the mystic rites. He was fascinated by sorcery and black magic. He was a brilliant science student, but he was only interested in forbidden experiments. And it says, one night the evil genius went too far, brought forth powers which he could not control. Now, this origin gets expanded like you cannot believe later on.
Does it?
Yes.
Okay.
There's all sorts of things that tie into this as to why he was involved in the mystic arts. That why he thinks Reed Richards caused his explosion. But no, in this, it's just there's an explosion. His face was badly disfigured and he's expelled from school. And Reed has not heard of him since then. But the last he heard of him, he was prowling the wastelands of Tibet, seeking forbidden secrets of black magic and sorcery. Just like Dr. Droom. And also, eventually, Doctor Strange. So, lots of people heading to Tibet.
Do all their powers between Doom, Droom, who would become Dr. Druid, and Strange, are they at all related?
No.
No? Okay.
And I think Lee took Tibet because that was kind of in pulp magazines, kind of the, that's where you go to learn about mysticism. Because that's where the Shadow got his power to cloud men's minds. It was just.
It always
kind of...
felt very like Lovecraftian. Always yes. Seemed to be that's where you went to.
Except in Lovecraft, didn't you just go to New England? Everything weird happened in New England.
It's true.
Doom demands that they surrender, and wants Sue Storm to be sent out. Let's see, here it is. Sue Storm's going to be held as a hostage to ensure that they will do what Doom says. And she instantly agrees. Sue Storm, girl hostage. And then that next page, the splash on part two.
Gorgeous. Look at that.
Gorgeous, and Joe Sinnott had it down to what he wanted things to look like way back here. This is very much what it would look like by issue 50. To my mind, that shows that Kirby was very dependent on inkers back then, because the earlier issues looked very crude, and this one looks very polished and smooth and has that Joe Sinnott sort of sheen to it. Fantastic Four, they surrender, of course, and they'll do what Doom says, because really the plot wouldn't work if they didn't.
If they fought it, yeah, yeah, because we need to... we need to have this plot work so we can get some time travel
yep.
shenanigans out of the way.
So they go in the helicopter to Doom's, the home of Dr. Doom, which is a castle. Obviously, upstate New York has tons of castles.
You didn't know that little fact about upstate New York?
I've never been.
Lousy with castles, Corey.
Ugh. See, I need to travel more.
Yeah, you can't throw a rock without hitting a castle.
But Doom is going to send the three members of the Fantastic Four back. He's keeping Zuza hostage, so he's sending Reed, Johnny, and Ben back into the past to get Bluebeard's treasure. Although he says, why can't you get the treasure yourself? I cannot. I must remain here to operate the machine. And then this is where Doom is given a little more than kind of the other villains in that Reed says, despite his other faults, Doom is not a liar. He will keep his word. And while that's just kind of tossed out there for this story to work, in future stories, that becomes very important, that what Doom says, when Doom makes a promise, he keeps it. He's a man of honor, and they keep adding to that through the series, which I think makes him much more interesting.
Yeah, yeah, that's one of the reasons I've always liked him, is he's never just been that villain who, I'm going to take over the world and do whatever, you know. It's he's always had more motivation there, even if it is just, you know, I'm the best person ever, so I should have all the power. It's never just been like, well, I just want to rule because...
Well, and one of the things that they've done in recent years that I like is they really play on the fact that Doom's people love him. And Doom has basically built up that he believes that humanity needs leadership. And he gives absolute leadership. He protects his people and they do what he wants. It's a perfect relationship in his mind, which again makes him more interesting than, I want to take over the world. Why? Because that's exactly what villains do. But here Doom has a time machine. So the Fantastic Four, Reed is kind of blown away that he has a time machine. It's one of those things where they're just kind of tossing it out there. And again, future writers will play with this. There's so much in these early issues that future writers and future creators just feed off of. But they go back in time, in their uniforms, of course, and discover a couple of nasty pirates who've stolen a bunch of clothes. They can steal the clothes and dress for the time without actually stealing anything, because they're just taking stuff away from the pirates. The thing, of course, I say they're mine. You want to make something of it?
Perfect. A whole bundle of suits and boots.
Yes.
So that's just how it works.
They disguise themselves, go to a bar to try and find out what's going on. They're immediately slipped a Mickey and wake up on a pirate ship. It's like the beginning of a Dungeons & Dragons adventure.
It is. It's also easily convenient.
Yes, but the next page, the part three. I adore this page so much. We've got the Thing in his disguise. Reed and Johnny are next to him. He wakes up, and there's this wonderful three-panel sequence at the bottom of the page, where the Thing's eye opens, he looks one way, he looks another way, and Kirby just kind of gives you that. For so little movement, there's so much in that. It's one of those things where when I talk about how Kirby understood this medium better than anyone, right there, that whole sequence was just wonderful, and it's just the Thing opening his eyes.
But it tells so much with just those three simple panels. Simple, yep, being, you know, understatement there.
And then the next page, we get a fight where they take over the ship. And it doesn't take very long. It's a page and a half, and they've taken over the ship.
It's the Fantastic Four versus some pirates. It's, yep, not going to take long. I love that panel on page 12, that perspective shot of,
yes,
Reed zipping up and punching the dude. And as I'm reading it, I was just like, oh, is that just his FF costume underneath, or did he actually find some pirate boots that stretch with him somehow?
But I also like that the Thing's doing the fight, and Johnny and Reed are just kind of sitting there watching. That's very much a very 40s movie comedy sort of bit. And I really like that sort of thing. It's almost like Kirby said, I wanted to do some swashbuckling stuff. And Lee said, okay. But they take over the ship, and the Thing kind of becomes the leader of the pirates. They attack another ship on the next page, and it does not take them long to take over, and they find the treasure. Not a lot of work in finding that treasure.
No, this story moves at a really good clip.
And Reed also realizes that if Doom wants this, there must be more to it than just a bunch of gems. Because why would you travel back in time to get a bunch of gems? And then the thing, because he's antisocial and has to have his outbursts, says he's not going back. He wants to be the leader of the pirates. I don't know, maybe he's Luffy from One Piece, but he wants to be the leader of the pirates, and he's going to fight to stay. He orders the pirates to tie up Reed and Johnny, and so how many times can the thing and the Human Torch turn on?
I don't know. I love those interactions, the fighting, the back and forth between the two. It's fun.
It is. And again, it was very different from other comics. You know, if you read a Justice League comic from the same time, everybody was the greatest pals. And Fantastic Four, nope. The Thing says, nah, screw you guys. I'm staying. And what stops him? They get hit by a tornado.
Yeah. Tornado out in the water.
Tornado destroys the ship, scatters the treasure, but they're able to find the treasure chest. And Reed says, I only promised to bring back Blackbeard's treasure chest, not his treasure. And when I reread it, it's like, no, you didn't. But okay, we'll give you that.
I was going to ask. I thought maybe I had missed something, but no, you're right.
They pull that rabbit out of their hat in a lot of stories where it's, okay, we need this twist, so this will happen.
So they get the chest, and here we are, going back in time to the present.
I also want to point out that the Thing apologizes, but he also has that pathos of, I was accepted here, and in our time, I'm a monster. One of the things about the Thing that's lost, because the book has been around for 50-some years, is the Thing did not like being the Thing. He was trapped in this monstrous form and was always looking for a way to escape it, always looking for a way to get back to either being himself or not to be considered a monster anymore. Doom brings him back in a beautiful sequence at the start of part 5, where it's his platform comes down and lowers through them, and they're back in the modern time. I love how Doom's time machine works. They've kept that through the years. And it's not like other time machines where, you know, this came out like a little after the adaptation of the time machine, where, you know, he got in the device and everything was swirling around him. Here, nope, it's just, boom, there you are.
What color is the rectangle of light?
It is yellow.
Since I'm looking in black and yellow, okay.
Yep, it is yellow. And they also kept that through the years. Believe it or not.
No, it is cool because it's just like a portal. It's, okay, here we go. It's going to zap you and you're back.
Reed gives the treasure chest and says, well, we only promised to bring back the treasure chest, not the treasure. And then in a piece of continuity, Johnny Storm says, Reed, the gems were well, we find out that he wanted the gems because they were created by Merlin. And they've got all sorts of mystic power that Doom craves. And Johnny Storm says, Reed, the gems were scattered to the bottom of the sea during the storm. What if the Submariner should find them? And there you have it, the first footnote.
Is that the first footnote ever in Marvel Comics?
That is the first footnote ever in Marvel. Submariner, see Fantastic Four, issue number 4 from May. Now, the footnotes would get much snarkier and funnier over the years, but this is the first one where it's, hey, read the previous issue.
Yeah. No, the footnotes were one of my favorite things when I started getting into comics, because that was like the gateway into me knowing, you know, besides issue numbers on the covers, but hey, this stuff ties together.
Yep.
Stuff from the past matters to what's being informed in the present. If you want, go out and hunt this stuff down. And I did.
And when I started reading, yo, I was a big fan of the Invaders because I liked the whole idea of the World War II heroes. And Roy Thomas, of course, being Roy Thomas, he would have characters referencing comics from the 40s. Go back and read Red Raven number 1 from 1940.
Sure, I'll get right on that.
But this is also the first Doom bot.
Yes!
Doom did not confront the Fantastic Four. He sent a robot to do it. And the room that they came back to the present in is a trap. And it's a pretty simple trap in that he's going to draw the oxygen out of the room. So the Human Torch can't flame on. The Thing's going to try and dig to get some oxygen. But who saves them? Sue Storm, because Doom hasn't been paying attention to her. She just kind of wanders off and opens the door for him.
Did she blow him up?
By becoming invisible, I can edge up to his control panel. I just activate his cutoff switch to short circuit the mechanism.
Well, that's a hell of a short circuit in panel 3 on page 21.
Yes. It opened an escape door. She's able to go and free them. Fantastic Four are together again. They escape from Doom's castle. And in one of the things, this is one of those things where it's, as a kid, I was like, oh, cool. And now that I'm an adult, it's like, no, that's not how it works. There's a moat filled with alligators. So how do they get past it? The Human Torch, by giving my flame the intensity of atomic heat, I can actually boil a section of the water away and rise and fuse the ground, turning it into a glass-like substance.
Science.
And then he creates a circle of flame around the castle so that Doom can't get out. Doom, of course, has a jetpack and takes off to get away to live to fight another day.
Which is going to be very soon. But before we get to that, I want to point out this issue. There were a lot of really cool shots of Reed using his powers in this issue. Just the angles that Kirby used to show them off. It's really dynamic.
And we've still got where the Human Torch can only use his flame for a short amount of time, but now he's able to get more intense with it. Because in previous issues, he wasn't able to do a whole lot with it. Here, he's able to create this atomic heat. And just one of the better issues of the early run. I really like this one. It moved really fast. There was a lot going on. Doom was more the planner and the plotter, and I like the fact that I'm not going to be in that room with you. I created a robot for that. Doom isn't a guy that they're going to go toe-to-toe with. He's a guy you got to outthink. And in the letters page, our first letter, I'll just read the letter. You know who wrote it afterward. Dear editor, Fantastic Four number 3 was excellent. The feud angle made it all the better, particularly the ending. The continuity in Fantastic Four is all that could possibly be asked. I just subscribed to the Fantastic Four for 2 years. I hope it runs much longer than that. Roy Thomas, Sullivan, Missouri. This was back when Roy Thomas was doing Alter Ego, one of the first fanzines. He had given the Fantastic Four a good review in that, and this was the early days of fanzines. So, Roy Thomas, one of the first, I think one of the first fans who ever made it.
Oh, yeah. It's a safe to say, yeah.
You know, there were a lot of artists who were fans of comic strips who got into comics. But really, until the 60s, there weren't a lot of comic book fans who made it in. And the other thing that's interesting is, if you read Alter Ego, because Roy's reprinted it a few times, it was very much about the DC heroes, especially the DC heroes of the 40s. So here he is, writing to the first Marvel mag. And I don't think I've read any in the... Well, they've done like 2 volumes of Best of Alter Ego. Now, there's a current Alter Ego, which is also edited by Roy. But the one he did in the 60s, I don't think he ever mentioned the timely heroes of the 40s. It was all about the DC heroes of the 40s.
All right, so this is a big deal if he's reading Marvel books.
Yep.
Being a DC kid.
And he gave Fantastic Four really good reviews in Alter Ego. At the bottom, I could not pick out any of the fake names, so if there were fake names in this letters page, I certainly couldn't pick them out. And Stan gave some pretty snarky answers. But at the bottom, all right, that's it for now. We're learning a lot from your letters. We've learned that you do like the name Mr. Fantastic, and that you don't like it. You do like the thing, and you don't like him. Well, we can't please everyone, but we're sure going to try. Keep the letters coming, and don't get too angry at us, and always face front. So
is that
there you go.
First you appearance of face front?
Yep, got your first face front.
Aha.
So all of Stan's little quirks in his writing are really there as he brings this stuff forward. And the letters page really makes it seem like, you know, we're just your pals, we're kidding around, we're having fun with this. Whereas over at DC, the letters pages were far more serious. The only one who really ran them was Julie Schwartz, and they were very much about, you know, the scientific facts of the what Green Lantern did was... And these are much more fun, much more fan-based. Anything else on Fantastic Four number 5?
You mentioning that tone in the letters column, and I think that's why it's carried over, or that's how I was more Marvel than a DC guy growing up, is that was still there in the 80s.
Yeah.
And it just made it feel like this is the fun place to be.
And it's one of the things that, for all the talk of who created what, Kirby and Ditko and Heck, and they may have created characters, but Stan created Marvel.
Yes.
And we'll get more into that as time goes on, because more and more of it starts to come through. Issue 6, we've got the first team-up of the Fantastic Four's two main villains. They didn't wait too long for the Submariner and Doctor Doom to come back.
No, they didn't. I love that. I love it. I feel like that shows that this is how important these two villains are to our heroes. That they're coming back pretty much immediately. You know, Doom back the next issue. Namor back 2 issues later from the last time you've seen him.
And back to inking, we are back to Dick Ayers as the inker. Dick Ayers' inks are a little cruder, mm-hmm. a little thicker. I like Dick Ayers' work. I think that on these early issues, it really worked. Of course, I love Joe Sinnott, but Dick Ayers' stuff is really good. The other thing about Dick Ayers that has helped us comic historians is he meticulously kept track of every comic he worked on. He actually had books where it's like, okay, job number V835. This many pages, was paid this much per page. He kept it for tax purposes, but he never threw them away.
I also see that his name is really, really tiny in that first panel on page 1 of issue 6, right in the lower right-hand corner of that.
I'm trying to see it here. Yep, there it is, Ayers.
Yeah.
Colored in with all of the windows. He was also doing penciling at the time, too. Did a lot of penciling on the horror books.
All right.
I think he also worked on a couple of the westerns. But we start with the Human Torch flying off. It's the Human Torch. He's heading for the Fantastic Four skyscraper headquarters. Now, this is the 6th issue, and they've already said, the Torch, he's a living legend.
Yeah, there it is, a living legend. 6 issues in, he's a living yep. legend.
Well, let's remember, by the 4th issue, they were putting on the cover the world's greatest comic magazine.
That's true.
Stan loved to, he loved the hyperbole. But it's in a lot of ways, this opening sequence is much like Fantastic Four number 1. The Human Torch is showing his powers by flying off to the Baxter Building. The Invisible Girl is showing off her powers by getting through a crowd and being invisible. Then we get an introduction to the Baxter Building.
We've had this just, I believe it was in issue 3.
Yep.
And
but
again,
in this one, we show that somebody's trying to get an autograph. And, well, they can't use the elevator because the Fantastic Four have a special thing on their belt that unlocks the elevator just for them. And I want to look and see if this is the same layout that they had for number in issue 3.
It is slightly different. They have added more rooms and more floors than was in issue 3.
Oh, yeah. So now they have an ammo room. Which, even as a kid, when I saw that one, it's like, ammo room? They don't shoot anything.
No, they don't. It just, this feels like, I think I said it in the previous episode, just like a kid making a fort.
Yep.
In a headquarters. It makes me think, and he probably got it from this, when I was reading Matt Groening's Life is Hell strips in the 80s, and you would see stuff like this and that.
Oh, they did this in comics all the time.
So.
Yo, the Batcave. Here's all the stuff in the Batcave. Superman's Fortress of Solitude. Here's all the stuff in that. The Justice League headquarters. You know, they really like doing these blueprint-type layouts. To the point where in the 80s, what was his name? Elliot Brown. He worked in production, but one of his jobs was to do the blueprints of the buildings, to research all the guns that people used. There was even a series called The Punisher Armory that was just, okay, here's all the stats for all the guns the Punisher has. And that thing went like 5, 6, 7 issues. So there was a demand for this. Nowadays, nobody cares,
yeah.
Which is fine. And we also get where the Fantastic Four are answering their fan mail in a really cool sequence where Reed goes to visit a kid who's in a hospital without leaving the Baxter Building. He just stretches all the way over to the hospital.
Which... He's souped up since last issue.
Yes.
He can stretch a lot farther now.
And this also, in the final panel, you've got the first appearance of the Yancey Street Gang.
Yes.
And to be honest, that panel with the thing with his mouth wide open like that always disturbed me. I don't know what it is about it. It just looks weird. His mouth is open bigger than his head.
Yeah, he looks like he's about ready to eat Johnny's head.
Yeah, but we get a nice introduction to the Fantastic Four, and, you know, that they're now celebrities, and they're sitting around talking about who's their worst villain.
Of the five they fought so far.
Yes, and we also get that Sue feels bad for the Submariner.
Oh, we're going to get to something here in a moment that I want to talk about, but... Yeah, that has to do with that, so...
And also, the Submariner was blinded with vengeance when we last saw him. Now, we see, and he's kind of okay with it, because he's hanging out with some dolphins.
Yeah, he's just chilling.
He's not planning on destroying the world, he's not planning on getting his vengeance upon the surface people. He just kind of ignores him until Dr. Doom shows up. And their team up is really pretty quick. It's Doom says, hey, come on in. We're going to punish and defeat the Fantastic Four. And that's the extent of it.
How did Doom know that Namor had an issue with them? I don't think it says anything in here.
Really, it's he's been looking for Submariner. And he says, finally, I found him. I knew my television scanner would pick him up at a low-level focus. Now, Submariner, we have work to do. I'll buzz him at wave height. That'll get his attention. Well, so a surface mortal dares to invade the privacy of Prince Namor.
I would think that they would be more like, hey, let's go find those stones that Merlin made magic and we lost. They're still there. But no, it's a different plan.
And Submariner takes Dr. Doom to his new Atlantis. He has built a new undersea world. Once he goes in, it's filled with oxygen. So in Submariner's home, he doesn't. He lives underwater, but he doesn't live in water.
No, but I absolutely love his house.
Yes.
That first panel on page 8, that room they're sitting in, just the way it's drawn and... everything. I love it. It's such a cool design.
And we get a recap of what the current origin of the Submariner, as Doom is playing upon Namor's emotions.
Yeah, and here's what I wanted to bring up. Where the hell did Namor get a framed picture of Sue Storm? Which is going to tie in a couple of pages coming up here in a minute, too.
Well, they're famous, so I imagine... that there's been photos in the newspaper. Also, back in the 50s and 60s, you could mail away for headshots of actors. And you could mail away for all kinds of photos. They don't reprint the ads in this, but in a lot of the Martin Goodman magazines, up until the early 70s, you could mail away for 8x10 glossies of Betty Page.
Okay.
From Irwin Claw, the guy who took all the pictures of her.
Yeah, that guy.
He would sell those through the mail. You wanted pictures of celebrities, there were people who would sell them. It was a booming business back then, to the point where I think, if I remember right, my mother said that she did actually mail away and got individual pictures of all four of the Beatles. She doesn't have them anymore, but in like 63, 64, she mailed away for them.
Were they autographed or anything, or were they were just photos?
They were just photos.
Okay.
Because most of the footage of them was in black and white. The Hard Day's Night was in black and white. She wanted color photos of the Beatles. Now, on the next page, those top three panels, again, shows how wonderful Kirby is at storytelling. Doom is revving up Namor, you know, because Namor seems to be kind of at peace with how things are now. Doom, no, look at what's happened. You need revenge. And the dialogue, Stan's dialogue with that, gone. All that glorious history, gone in one brief instant, replaced by an ugly crater in the ocean floor, littered with diffused masonry and bitter memories that cry out, revenge, revenge. And it starts with Namor, you know, with his head in his hands, sobbing, and slowly it comes up to where he's furious again. He's ready for revenge, and he'll agree to work with Doom to get that revenge.
Yeah, it's a really spectacular sequence, those three panels.
And we now see Doom's new toy. He's got a grabber that he can control through radio waves that can pick up, use magnets to pick up anything, even if it's stone. And so we get a demonstration of what this thing will do, and then Doom's going to have it disassembled. Namor's going to put it in his belt and reassemble it later. I don't think I could reassemble it, but I guess Namor could.
Well, he's a smart guy.
Another thing that I find interesting is, you know, they use the original coloring in the omnibus. Namor is basically known for what color trunks?
Green.
These are red, and they're red all the way through. So I wonder if whoever colored it didn't know about Namor's look in the 40s or even in Fantastic Four number 4. But Namor, who last we saw was trying to destroy New York with a giant monster that had to be killed with an atomic bomb, shows up walking the streets toward the Baxter Building. Meanwhile, the
that's a great crowd
11,
shot.
Yes. Meanwhile, at the bottom of page 11.
Yes.
There's something glistening behind a shelf of books.
Yes. What could it be? This is going back to the photo of Sue Storm that Namor has. Sue has a photo of Namor.
She must have got it from Irwin Claw as well.
Yeah.
Mailed away and got it.
That, you know, did photos glisten in the 60s, Corey?
Well, they were glossy.
Okay.
You know, because there was a matte finish and gloss finish. But again, you know, the Human Torch acts like a snarky 16-year-old who's teasing his sister.
Have they established yet in these six issues that Sue and Reed are a couple? Like, really a couple?
Not really.
Yeah.
Because when I went back and reread it, it's like, well, they're kind of together, but there's nothing romantic in these other than every once in a while he'll say, my darling. But there's... You don't get that feeling that they're close.
No, not at all. So it's like I don't know what the issue is, other than he's a bad guy and she shouldn't like the bad guy.
Well, and in this, when Reed shows up, he doesn't say, "Hey, why is my girl mooning over some guy?" It's, "I think you owe us an explanation, Sue." And also, there have been a couple of times when Ben Grimm is like, "Well, why isn't she, you know, if I wasn't so hideous, maybe she'd fall for me." That doesn't last very long, thankfully. It's kind of like when Professor X had the hots for Jean Grey when she was 16.
That's just where my brain went.
But they're feeling their way. They're trying to figure out what they're doing, and not everything falls in place at once.
No, it doesn't.
So the Human Torch just kind of walks in. Of course, the Thing wants to beat the crap out of him. Reed holds him back so that they can hear his side of the story. And Sue actually puts herself between the Submariner and the rest of them. She's going to protect him. She wants to hear him out.
Because she's got the hots for him.
And we get some nice demonstration of powers here, where Human Torch is able to cut through the floor. Thanks. Thanks for that repair bill. And Submariner's able to just fly using the wings on his feet. So I like the fact that they're, you know, establishing the powers. Got to show what these people can do. The next page, Doom's plan goes into effect. The grabber grabs the Baxter Building and takes it into the air.
Yeah, and I know this won't be the last time the Baxter Building is lifted off the ground by Doom. Because I do know enough that Byrne does that.
Yes,
about 25 years later.
Homage to it. But that was Doom's plan. He's going to kidnap the Baxter Building. They seal up the windows so that the air can't escape. And then they, you know, put helmets on. And the Human Torch, showing he's not the brightest bulb, tries to go out the window on flame, and nope, they're in space. Yep. There's no air in space.
That's not going to work, Johnny.
So instead, the way they're going to try to attack is Reed is going to use the powers he showed earlier in the issue and stretch to grab Doom's plane. However, Doom is able to blast him and keep him from grabbing the plane. Now, the Submariner, who started all this, has decided that, hey, I don't think Doom's really on my side at this point.
No.
Has there been any time where... No, he doesn't say anywhere that he's being double-crossed. Doom doesn't say he's being double-crossed. Of course, because Reed's not able to stop him, the Thing tries to beat the crap out of Submariner again. This is all your fault. Doom comes over the speaker, saying, to those of you who are still alive to hear these words, I can tell we are near the close of this little journey, but before I part with your delightful company, I shall set your building on a collision course with the sun. I am certain we'll receive you warmly.
Oh, Doom.
If you will forgive my little jest.
At least he apologizes.
Well, and that's one of the few times Doom ever cracks a joke. But that's Doom's plan. He's going to grab the Baxter Building, throw it into the sun.
It's a good plan.
So the Fantastic Four and the Submariner need to team up to stop Doom. Submariner gets into a pool so that he can regain his strength. And then the bottom of the next page, he leaps out and is going to use the asteroids to go toward Doom's plane. But again, another great three-panel sequence.
Yeah, this is rad.
Where the Submariner's right toward the reader, very much the Kirby foreshortening of him coming toward you.
Go, go, go!
Yep.
Yeah.
This whole sequence just feels like it's motion. It shows a lot of difference between how other artists would draw this sort of thing in Kirby. Kirby actually is going to show the motion. He's going to show what happens. Comparable comics at the time, I remember one of the examples that Stan always used is, okay, the Superman's going over to London, and there's a sea monster there. Superman flies down and punches the sea monster and saves the ship and goes on. In our story, the whole story would have been fighting the sea monster. But in the Superman story in the 60s, it's, okay, one punch and he saved everybody and moves on. So he gets to Doom's plane, and again, magnetism. Stan didn't quite understand magnetism at the time. Maybe he's a member of the Insane Clown Posse. Magnets, how do they work? Nobody knows. The Submariner tears his way into the ship, and Doom shocks him with electricity. And in a power he never showed before or after, the Submariner is able to channel the electricity as if he is taking the power of an electric eel to blast his way in. Doom escapes from his ship, grabs onto an asteroid, and takes off.
Yeah, and this is where I am excited to get into more issues to see how Doom gets back from outer space. Or, you know, I guess maybe that could have just been Doombot.
Well, one of the things that was always kind of cool about Doom in the Fantastic Four is it would look like he had died or was about to die. And his next, when he would return, his return would be a part of the story rather than him just showing up.
All right.
Which doesn't sound like a big deal, but let's remember, in Superman, every story ended with Lex Luthor in prison. And then the next story, well, Lex Luthor's doing something. How'd he get out of prison? Kids didn't care. But they bring the Baxter Building back, and they don't explain how. They just say, while back on Earth, the hour's late, the dark streets deserted on Skyscraper Row, and the stray individuals who later witnessed the silent return of the Baxter Building from the skies write it off as a bad dream, an hallucination resulting from the anxieties that plague our nuclear society. But to the Fantastic Four, the sight of the city is a miracle greater than their incredible experience. There we go. The Submariner and Dr. Doom's spaceship guided the building back onto its foundation. So the Fantastic Four owe the Submariner their lives.
Yes, they do.
They try to dislodge the Grabber, but nope. Namor takes it and takes Doom's spaceship and the Grabber and dumps it in the sea. And that's the end of our issue. Any other commentary on that one before we go into the letters page?
Oh, no. Just, again, it's just like you were saying, they're figuring things out. We have our first ever supervillain team up, which it goes okay. I never felt like Namor was really into it I felt like Doom got him kind of wound up for a bit, and even then, by the time he got to the Baxter building, it was just kind of like his emotions had worn off a little bit. He seems to run very hot and cold.
Yes.
Depending on what, if it's like he's being agitated right then and there, which would explain why, you know, he was okay just swimming around with the dolphins. So
yeah, the Fantastic Four fan page. I want to point out that in issue 4 of the Fantastic Four, we have announced a $5 prize for the reader sending in the best explanation for the Invisible Girl's disappearing gem. Remember, we talked about in Fantastic Four number 2, when the Skrull shrank, the gem disappeared too.
Uh-huh.
Well, somebody wrote in a letter in Fantastic Four number 4 and said, well, how did that work? Well, they offered a $5 prize. And it says here, we've received so many correct answers, all well written and carefully thought out. The only fair thing was to award the $5 to the fan sending in the letter, which we received first. And this name is someone you may know. If you are into literary fiction, or you read the recent reboot at Marvel, and by recent, I mean 12 years ago. God, I'm old.
Oh.
Jonathan Latham, who wrote the reboot of Omega the Unknown, and has written a number of Pulitzer Prize-winning novels. Jonathan's winning answer told that it was not Susan Storm who disappeared, but one of the Skrulls impersonating her by shrinking in size. The gem vanished by being carried away, unseen by the minute-sized Skrull. Letters which we later received also contain the correct answer. Inasmuch as we cannot send $5 to all the writers, we're doing the next best thing and printing their names below. Thanks and congratulations to all the sharp-eyed fans. P.S. This letter is being set in type on March 14th, 1962, so the names which follow are those received up to that date. They have a whole list of names there. There's a whole bunch of people.
And how many of them do we know?
I'm looking. It doesn't look like any.
Okay.
But still, Jonathan Latham. One of the things I like in these early Fantastic Fours is the people who either went on to work in comics or kind of became famous people later on. But that one I'd read about years ago, that one of the reasons he wanted to work for Marvel was because of this. That is issue 6. Probably one of the better issues.
Yeah.
Next is one of the worst.
Oh, God.
Issue 7, we start with a cover that shows the Fantastic Four are wanted dead or alive. And it says, we escaped just in time. We can't remain on Earth any longer. We've got to head to Planet X.
Yeah.
Why does the human race turn against the Fantastic Four? Only the master of Planet X knows the answer. And we start with the Kurgo, Master Planet X. Now, you know how I've said that they reused all the concepts from the Fantastic Four?
Yeah.
Kurgo has not been used again. Yep, he was.
He was?
In a Marvel Feature, back when Marvel Feature was doing Thing team-ups, Kurgo started a fight between the Hulk and the Thing by Jim Starlin. Even Kurgo gets used again. Kurgo is the master of Planet X. He is looking at Earth through a TV screen, which is a whole bunch of ways away, and we find out that the planet they're on, Planet X, is about to be destroyed by a runaway asteroid. So he sends a spaceship with his robot servant to go bring the Fantastic Four to Planet X to save them. The Fantastic Four, on the other hand, are getting ready to speak before Congress, which is one of the weirder ways that they've shown their powers.
Yeah.
Human Torch says that if he has to give a speech, he'd probably screw it up and light on fire. Let's see, I'd probably get all tense and nervous, and the next thing we know, it would just be my luck to burst into flame. We know that he can control his flame. It's one of those things where I think Jack did the pages, and Stan was like, okay, I gotta figure out some reason why he would be, you know, doing this, because we got to show the powers. The Thing would get irritated, and if they pulled off his disguise, he'd get angry and start smashing things. But at the bottom of page 3, we get the Thing and the Human Torch going at it again, where the Human Torch is taking a shower. And I love that panel at the bottom of page 3. That looks like a comedy panel.
Yes.
Right there. Very much Bigfoot cartooning. Thing turns off the cold water so the Human Torch bursts into flame. Setting off all the alarms. And it's also the first time we've seen Reed doing an experiment, because most of the time Reed's not doing much, but this time he's mad at the shenanigans going on because they could disrupt the rocket fuel experiment.
Okay. Yeah. That would be the first time. I got more distracted by Reed's really flat head coming out of the air vent on in panel 5 on page 4. That is awesome.
Yeah.
You know, I just love it when like Kirby throws these little things like that in the book.
Also, this issue is inked by Dick Ayers. I don't know if I said that earlier. This one is inked by him as well.
Okay.
Don't know if he signed it, but he did ink this one. As the spaceship comes, we learn that the Marvel Universe is more advanced than ours because they've already got spy satellites. And this was at a time where we really didn't have a lot of satellites up there. Let us leave the Fantastic Four to their bickering for a moment and watch the new strange form enter the Earth's atmosphere, the form of a starship from outer space. At this very instant that we notice it, one of America's new eye-in-the-sky satellites also flashes the word to the command headquarters below. So the government knows what's coming. Fantastic Four get in the original Fantastic Car, the flying bathtub, and take off for Washington, D.C.
Which is where the robot has landed.
And I got to be honest, I love Kirby's work, but that panel at the top of page 6 of the robot coming out, it's not very good.
No, it's not.
I don't like that drawing at all. The robot doesn't look good. It looks extra cartoony in a lot of ways. But the robot is, let's see here. He uses his beam to find the Fantastic Four just as they land and they go to the Capitol where they're having dinner with congressmen. And they receive a trophy as a symbol of the gratitude of your fellow countrymen. And the robot who was sent to retrieve them, rather than just going and get them, he's going to use a ray that makes people get very irritated with each other.
Yeah. I just feel like, okay, this is the Fantastic Four. I feel like they could have sent this robot with a message that just would have been like, hey, we need your help. And they would have come and helped.
Or, if you needed a fight scene where the robot tries to capture them, they fight him and get taken away. However, this is it's almost like they came up with the cover and it's all right, we need to justify the cover.
Yeah.
So they're at this congressional dinner to get a big trophy, and instead the congressmen turn against them. Not the first time, not the last time. So the military's after them. We get some more comedy at the bottom of page 9 where the soldiers are coming at Reed, and he grabs a chandelier, goes up to the ceiling, and the soldiers all run into each
other. Yeah, that's a fun sequence.
And the Thing hides behind a secret door. He lifts the wall up, closes it back down, and then for some reason he's digging his way out from under a bus. And I don't care how many times I read that, it doesn't quite track for me.
No.
I also like the sequence where they're going to be having a dogfight with the UFO, and they have to strap themselves in because they're going to go upside down. I like that sequence. I thought that was well done. But eventually they land at the Baxter Building where the robot comes out. Heed my words, puny earthlings. I have traveled many light years to find you and bring you a message from Kurgo, Master of Planet X. He also shows that everybody on Earth hates him before giving the message. Guess what? I have a message for you. By the way, everybody here thinks you suck.
Come with me.
And they look down below, and yes, there's down below, there's an angry mob. The robot explains that no matter where they go, they're going to be attacked and kidnapped and captured. So they might as well come along. Only I, the servant of Kurgo, can offer you asylum. You will only be safe if you come with me.
I love that panel.
Yes. So they decide to go.
Hey, even in this issue that is not good, there's still some really fantastic art in here.
Yes, Kirby does his best with what's going on. My issue isn't really the art. It's the story is all over the place.
Yeah.
Like this, I have a message from Kurgo. Come with me and we'll give you asylum. Not, hey, our planet's in trouble and we need your help.
Yeah.
Not, come with me or I'll destroy you. It's, hey, come with me or everybody's going to keep hating you. So they are brought to Planet X through an asteroid belt. I love this page. I absolutely love this page. At the start of part four, finally, after hours of voyaging through space, the whirling starship reaches planet X, then a hatch slowly opens, and before they know it, the Fantastic Quartet find themselves floating down to the surface, descending gently on invisible means of anti-gravity matter.
Yeah, it's a really nice page. And I love the layout, and it also kind of makes me think of the cover to Amazing Spider-Man number one.
Yeah.
That has the Fantastic Four on it, with the way Reed is kind of posed. It feels very much like that the way Spider-Man was drawn on the cover of Amazing number one.
Yeah.
Maybe that was intentional.
I don't know. Spider-Man number one, that cover was drawn by Ditko.
Yeah.
And he and Kirby, they didn't hate each other, but they were very different artists. It could be that that's just kind of a standard pose. The next page, Kurgo finally explains what's going on. The planet X is already in trouble because this asteroid is coming toward it. It's causing floods. It's causing volcanoes. People driven by fear and panic. Our people are turning against each other, so nothing will be able to stop the riots. Nothing except the doom which is hurtling toward us. And on the next page, Reed asks, well, why can't everyone escape in spaceships? And Kurgo explains, well, we weren't really interested in space exploration. We only have two ships, the one that we got you and this one we're using to evacuate some people in. But they've got 5 billion inhabitants.
And not a lot of time to get the planet evacuated.
No.
Just,
And again, you know, Reed asks for time to think. The thing, he wants to go back immediately, tries to start a fight with the robot, and gets his ass handed to him. Again, we're not going to get a big fight sequence here.
No.
Human Torch tries to take him on, and this is, I think, the first time when we get the supernova flame. Because before it was the atomic flame. This time it's supernova. And Reed is screaming at him not to do it because he won't have control over it. Again, Sue stops the Human Torch by standing in front of the bad guy.
So that happens, and they all agree to, or Reed agrees to come to a solution to save the planet.
Yes.
Oh, God, and the solution just does not hold water.
Now, first off, that splash page on part five, that's very much Kirby machinery.
Yes, it's awesome.
And it's a sequence where we will get this sequence all the time where the thing is carrying around heavy stuff for Reed to build something. Absolutely adore that idea. It's something that Kirby goes back to again and again and again, and especially when you get to what I call the golden age of that between issues 40 and 70. It's almost every issue the thing is doing that. It's such a cool way to show off the machinery and to show this thing's strength. But Reed's solution is he's going to shrink everybody down so that they all fit into the spaceship.
Yeah. The plan itself, I don't have a problem with, Corey. It's the execution of said plan. How are they going to get all the people on the planet? I mean, they do explain it with the smaller ships to get them to the bigger spaceship, but it just seems like coordinating an evacuation of that size still wouldn't be time to do it.
They've only got 24 hours, and Reed had to take the time to figure it out and create the shrink gas, and then they're going to bomb the planet with the shrink gas. Who knows how they communicated it to everybody.
Right.
Fantastic Four have to get to the flying saucer that they got there in. So there's a sequence as the planet is falling apart that they've got to rush to get there. Gives you a little bit of a ticking clock, which, you know, in your story construction, you start your third act with a ticking clock. So there's our ticking clock. But then on the last page, as everybody's loading into the ship, Kurgo decides that, no, the enlarging gas, I'm going to keep it. I will never use it, and then I will rule the planet. But he doesn't make it to the spaceship in time, so he's trapped on the planet. Wait, I can't run to the ship. I can't leave the enlarging glass. I can't give up my dream of absolute power. Wait, your master commands you. And as the rocket ship takes off, Kurgo is left there on the planet, as Kurgo's cries are drowned out by the rocket's roar, as 5 billion living beings minus one streak toward a new home and a new life. And then there's an error, and I don't know if they fixed the error in the essential. They do not fix any of the errors in the omnibus. This is just as it was printed. Reed's explanation, are you sure the enlarging gas will work? when they reached their new home, Reed, after all, you never had time to test it. Reed says, there was no reducing gas, Sue. It was just an empty projectile.
Okay. They fixed it in the essentials. It does say there was no enlarging gas.
So there's your ironic ending. Kurgo died with enlarging gas that didn't exist. I only told them about it so they could consent to my plan. But once they reach their new world, it won't matter. They'll all be the same size. And in this vast universe of ours, one size is only relative anyway. So the Fantastic Four now have a spaceship that can go to another planet within hours. Doom has a time machine. And we've had two alien invasions.
All in seven issues.
No big names on the letters page. A lot of jokes on the letters page. Let's see here. I like your new mag, but let's watch it. In Chapter 3 of the Fantastic Four, Number 5, you show Mr. Fantastic stretching up to KO a pirate. They didn't make rubberized clothes in those days, you know? Stan's reaction? Oops. Which is something that you pointed out.
I did.
And then the thing at the end of the letters page, again, showing Stan's goofy dad sense of humor. That wraps it up for this issue, fans. By the way, we thought of a great way to get revenge on anyone who might write us a too critical letter. We'll spell his name wrong when we print it. Oh, the power we editors have.
Oh, Stan.
And the next issue?
And our final issue of episode 2?
Yes, our final issue of episode 2.
Issue 8.
Introduces one of the longest-running supporting characters in the Fantastic Four, and one of their longer-running villains. It is the prisoners of the Puppet Master.
Oh, God, he's freaky looking.
Yes, he is. Very much like a 40s Kirby villain. Kirby's villains were all very weird-looking in the 40s, especially in Captain America. You know, you look at those early drawings of the Red Skull, and he's freaky as hell, to the point where in the 50s, the comics code, well, even in the 60s, the comics code made them redraw those 40 stories so that the Red Skull didn't look so freakish.
Okay.
But issue 8, by the way, I don't know, did we already mention that these are 12 centers? Yeah, we did, because only the first issue is a 10 center. The second issue was a 12 cent comic.
Was that a big deal?
No, second issue was a 10 cent. Third issue was a 12 center. Well, it's the first time comic prices went up.
Okay.
Since the introduction of comics. So the 12 cent, there were only two issues in the Marvel Universe that were 10 cents, and that's Fantastic Four 1 and 2. The next price hike wouldn't be for years, and it would be to 15 cents. I always thought 12 cents was a weird price.
It is odd.
But if you read some reminiscences from people like Fred Hembeck or Bill Shelley or even Roy Thomas, they talk about comics going up to 12 cents was kind of a big deal because you didn't get as many with your dollar as you used to.
All right. Yeah, that would only be, what, 9 books instead of 10?
So this issue starts, Reed Richards is working on something that they're trying to keep secret from the Thing. And the Thing is back in his disguise.
Is this back to a Joe Sinnott inked book?
I don't believe okay. so.
I just...
No, this is not.
Okay.
This is still Dick Ayers.
All right.
And you can tell, if you're somebody who knows the art, how people draw, go to page 11, and you'll see the really dark outlines of the figures. That's very much a Dick Ayers thing.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah. It's just...
You start to learn how different artists would draw things.
It's just that Reed on page 1 looks a little bit cleaner than some of the Ayers' work in these issues.
Yeah, very handsome in that issue.
Yeah.
But Sue's trying to hold him back, and for the first time... The Thing actually attacks her. And the Thing is very much, this isn't, you know, joking around shenanigans. Nope, the Thing is furious and he's going to fight his way through. To the point where at the end of the second page, it's stow it, chum. I'm fed up to hear with your smooth talk. I'm cutting out of this combo as of now. The Fantastic Four can go to blazes for all I care.
And he storms off.
Sue tries to convince him to stay. And we do get some comedy where Sue's talking and, you know, two people on the street don't see her, so they think the Thing's talking to himself, till Sue kicks one of them in the behind. Then we get somebody climbing up. I imagine this is either the Brooklyn Bridge or the George Washington Bridge. So, while they haven't said that they're in New York, they're in New York now. Kirby's actually using landmarks in New York. And someone has climbed to the top of the bridge and is about to jump off. So, Sue fires the flare. Reed stretches all the way to the bridge.
Yeah, his powers just keep getting more and more powerful.
Yep, but he can't make it, so the Human Torch goes. And then we see that someone has built a tiny puppet and has caused the man to climb up to the top of the bridge. And when the Human Torch rescues him, this man's puppet burns him. And we find out that only one living creature could have done this. It means the Human Torch will be the Puppet Master's next villain. And the reason the Puppet Master did this was to show his power to people.
But who was he showing, really? Because nobody knew he was doing this.
Right. But it does say, you a nameless nobody will be the first test of my power. And then the next page, we get our first look at Alicia Masters, who calls him dad, but he is not happy about that. He wants to just be called stepdad.
Yeah, that's so weird.
It is. It's one of the weirder things. But they do follow that up in their relationship over time, where she's always very fond of him and understands him, and he pushes her away. Until it's convenient for the story.
Right.
The fun thing is that he says he's going to take over the Human Torch. No, he takes over the thing instead and causes the thing to... well, he'd already said he was leaving the Fantastic Four, but it's radioactive clay that he's been using to create these puppets. And for some reason, with this radioactive clay, he can control people. So he brings the thing to his apartment. Sue Storm has followed, but because the Puppet Master could tell she's there, he fills the room with gas and knocks her out.
Okay, and he puts gas mask on everybody else. How? Yeah,
yes.
All right.
And then he disguises Alicia as Sue Storm, and she just goes along with
it.
She's okay with
this. This is just, God, that relationship is so just bizarre that she would just let him cut her hair.
And, this is also her first meeting with the thing who's being mind controlled, but still she says, this man, his face feels strong and powerful, and yet I can sense a gentleness to him. There is something tragic, something sensitive. And he sends them off to go infiltrate the Fantastic Four, to which Alicia says, this is all so strange, I do not understand, but I must do as I'm told. She's not being controlled, by the way. She's just doing what her stepfather is telling her to do.
I feel like Alicia's the first person who ever gets Ben.
Yes, and it's the first time we ever see kind of Ben not be angry all the time. They set this up really, right there at first panel, they've set up their relationship. Alicia's the only one who sees the man behind the monster because she's blind. And then we get Puppet Master is also gonna mess with the prison. At the same time. So we've got two stories going at once. The thing returns to the Baxter building, and even though he stormed out and said he was done, when he shows up, it's, oh, look, Reed, it's Sue, back with the thing. They're coming back right now. The thing grabs the Human Torch. Human Torch yells for Reed, saying the thing has gone mad. And then we get a fight between the thing and the Reed Richards and the Human Torch, and it isn't their normal shenanigans. Nope, the thing is out to kill him. He smashes Reed's experiment he's been working on, and when he does so, he returns to being Ben Grimm.
Yes.
Which, of course, breaks the Puppet Master's spell. So that's what Reed was working on, that he was keeping secret from Ben. And this is the first time we get this, where Reed is trying to cure Ben. Now, this is one of those plot points that I would imagine by the time you were reading, they did not touch on. But through, I would say, the first 15 years of the Fantastic Four, that was one of the major points, that Reed was always working on a way to cure Ben.
Yeah, it seemed by the time I got around to reading any of it, that wasn't an issue. It was just Ben was the thing, and that was it.
But the cure, like all of the cures we've seen so far, does not last very long. But when he returns to being the thing, he's not under control anymore. And this is the part that the middle of page 13, Alicia has recognized that Ben Grimm is the thing without all, as a human, Ben becomes the thing again. I'm back to being the thing again. It must be that chemical stuff. It only works when it's on me, but when it dries off, I go back to normal. But the clinker is, she likes me better as the thing. Now, not only is this a plot point that they use through the series, but it's also something that Byrne grabbed, where none of Reed's cures worked because Ben wanted to be the Thing, because if he wasn't the Thing, he'd lose Alicia.
Okay.
Basically, Lee's putting that in for pathos, and a later writer grabs it and says, ah, I can use this to explain other things. Meanwhile, back at the prison, the puppet master has got the warden to release all the prisoners. Sue Storm wakes up from being knocked out, tries to escape, and gets turned into a puppet. Well, the puppet master makes a puppet of her so that she can't. But Reed, Johnny, and Ben, because Ben has been cured, they're on their way back. They leave Alicia at the Baxter building, thankfully. And there's a giant, mentally controlled puppet waiting for them when they get to the puppet master. So we do get our fight scene.
Yes, we do.
And then the puppet master escapes using his puppet of a Pegasus.
Yeah, it's so random.
And, of course, he has Sue with him because, you know, Sue has to be the hostage. But she's rescued really quickly.
Yeah, yeah. Just kind of yanks her right off. Reed does.
And then, of course, as with if you watch Mystery Science Theater 3000, you know that there is a channel that just gives news bulletins that are needed for the plot as they all get, you know, kind of regroup at the puppet master's apartment. The radio says, bulletin, there's a strange riot at the state prison. The most dangerous prisoners in the nation broken free. The warden's trustee himself opened the gates. So they're off to stop the prison riot. And here we get some good old-fashioned Fantastic Four action. Human Torch melts his way into the prison. The Thing bashes his way into the prison. Tossing prisoners around like they're rag dolls. And then grabs a bunch of, what is it here?
It's a,
iron cell doors. Yeah. And turns it into a prison cell that he drops on all the prisoners. They start shooting at Reed, who absorbs the bullets and fires them back.
That is so awesome.
They defeat the prisoners pretty easily. Meanwhile, in a lonely room hidden away in the canyons of the metropolis, of this metropolis, a tearful girl stares out the window with sightless eyes. Yes, Alicia, I never knew, I never suspected what a menace my stepfather was. What if he should return and expect me to help with future plans? So she must have went back to the apartment, and of course he shows up. It's his apartment, too.
Right.
And he makes a puppet of himself as a king, and he describes how he is going to have the Fantastic Four as his slaves. He's going to basically, he's going to control everything. Alicia tries to grab the puppet from him. It falls down, and the puppet master falls out a window. Deus ex machina once again. So when the Fantastic Four show up, he fell out the window. We saw him down below. Don't cry, Alicia. Everything will be okay, kid. I swear it.
What happened, Reed? What made the puppet master fall? I wonder if we'll ever really know.
So there you go. There's a new villain. Now, the next page is a Fantastic Four feature page where they explain the Human Torch's powers.
Okay, I don't have that.
We get a page explaining the unstable molecules with a really cool Kirby drawing of molecules rearranging themselves. So, as my flame increase, they vary their structure depending on the degree of heat. My clothes, of course, are all chemically treated, completely burn resistant, as is every bit of furniture in my room, which I spray daily with a special chemical vapor. See here, he talks about his different powers, including creating he can hurl volcanic fireballs of any kind, but one of my most spectacular feats, which I dare not attempt too often, is to create a supernova fireball whose heat approximates that of an exploding sun.
Jesus.
So yeah, the other thing is this issue, I think, yep, it is this issue. Was it last issue? I want to double check, because this is around the time the Human Torch got his own solo series. Yes, it was last issue where they announced it. Somebody wrote in and said, I'm 14 and I like teenagers, so I like the Human Torch. I really feel sorry for the Thing. Is Reed Richards any relation to the Invisible Girl or the Human Torch? Many readers have written in asking what the Fantastic Four's relationship with each other is. Apparently, many of you missed our first issue, so to explain, the Human Torch and the Invisible Girl are brother and sister. Mr. Fantastic has been a good friend of Sue's. Oh, friend zone. And the Thing was the pilot they hired to fly them on their ill-flighted space voyage. The next letter is they're asking for, will each character get their own solo story? And they say, Regarding the Torch, many of you readers have clamored for Johnny to appear in other magazines, so don't miss Strange Tales 101 on sale now. You've got a pleasant surprise for you. Now, I don't know if we want to go over those Strange Tales stories, or I might just do it as a regular Solitaire Rose series in review, but they were very different from this, even though they were also by Lee and Kirby, in that Sue and Johnny Storm lived in a small town, and Johnny's identity as the Human Torch was kept a secret.
Okay. Might be cool to check out.
Even though in the Fantastic Four, they're all well known, and, you know, they're going to meet Congress as themselves with TV cameras and everything. The letters page for number 8 has nothing really interesting other than, let's see, somebody actually writes in and says, please don't play with the black magic theme very often. Stan says, as for the black magic thing, as you call theme, as you call it, we'll try not to overdo it. But tell us, what would you call the thing? So again, people saying, you know, some of the people liked the superhero name, some of them didn't. Anything you have to say about that issue before we close up for the day?
No, it was much better than issue 7. And
yeah,
it's fun to see the introduction of Alicia Masters and, you know, kind of knowing where her and Ben's story goes over the next 50-some years. And I'm just freaked out by the Puppet Master's character design.
They tone it down in future issues, but they still kind of keep him looking that weird.
Yeah, these were fun, and much like episode 1, we had 3 solid stories and 1 kind of stinker.
It's funny because I read these in the Masterworks back when the Masterworks came out. And I'd also read the first 6 issues. Marvel reprinted them in like a little, you know, regular paperback book, the first 6 issues. And I read that thing and read that thing and read that thing and read that thing and read that thing. So when the Masterwork came out, it's like, oh, cool, I can read 7, 8, 9, and 10.
Okay.
And I read 7, and I remember at the time going, wow, this is really bad. And the story just doesn't hold together in any way. It really feels very slapdash, almost like there were a bunch of ideas crammed together that just didn't work. And Kurgo, just his motivation didn't quite make a lot of sense. In the beginning, he's, I need to save my planet. And then it's, no, I need to rule everybody. It almost feels like they started one story and then did a second story and then did a third story and then tried to cram them all together. But the Puppet Master story I liked a lot because it gave the villain something interesting to do. And as he realized his power, his ambition grew.
Right.
So there you go. There's the second 4 issues of the Fantastic Four.
They were great. And looking ahead for episode 3, I see we get a little bit more Namor.
In one of my favorite Namor stories ever. That issue 9 story, if you're reading along with us, go ahead and read that one early. That's one of my favorite stories ever. And first time I read it, I didn't actually read it, drawn by Jack Kirby.
There you have it, true believers. Another 4 weeks has gone by. Another 4 issues have been read and discussed for you. Let us know what you think of the show so far. And by the time issue or episode 3 drops, we'll hope to have this on iTunes and all the other places that you can grab a podcast.
And speaking of other podcasts and where you could grab other podcasts, every episode of a podcast here on Solitaire Rose Network has ads, and here they are. Promotional consideration is paid for by the following sponsors. Our first sponsor is DreamHost.com. DreamHost.com has been with us since the beginning. They're the best web host in the whole known universe. And if you need a web host, and you do because, you know, Facebook, Google+, everything gets hacked. But if you set up your own web page, it'll never get hacked. Unless you kind of make some mistakes or pick an easy password like password. But still, you can have your own web page. If you use the code CRAZY, K-R-A-Y-Z, you get $20 off your first year. When you're at the office, do you often run to the vending machine for snacks? Those things are terrible for you. Instead, have snacks delivered to you. So go to graze.com. Graze.com has healthy snacks that you can decide what kind of snacks you want, how often you want them, whether they get delivered to you, or if you choose them every time. I myself get the subscription box every 2 weeks so that I have healthy things to eat when I'm at work. You can get a free box by using the code CORYS3R5P. Matter of fact, use that code, your fifth and your first box are free. Again, that's CORYS3R5P. If you'd like to advertise on any of the Solitaire Rose Podcast Network shows, you can. Just send us an email at solitairerosenetwork@gmail.com. Thanks. Got to pay the bills somehow.
Yes, we do.
So this hosting doesn't come cheap, and the omnibuses aren't cheap either. Although I buy them pretty cheap.
Yes, you do.
Go over to Crazy Comics and Stories, and I'll give you my secrets of buying omnibuses really cheap. Like, I think this Fantastic Four one I got, I actually got for like 70% off.
Wow.
So thanks for listening. Thanks for dropping by. And we'll be talking to you in a month.
Thanks, folks. See you then.